for Christmas Eve, a chance to hear again, with great pleasure, Beryl Reid's Christmas Collection, in which she presents some of her favourite poetry and prose, in company with Yvonne Dalpra and, at the piano, Geoffrey Head, before an invited audience at the theatre club, the Redgrave Theatre, Farnham. Beryl Reid.
When I was one, I'd just begun. When I was two, I was nearly new. When I was three, I was hardly me. When I was four, I wasn't much more. When I was five, I was just alive. But now I am six. I'm as clever as clever. So I think I'll be six now, forever and ever. If only I could have stopped there. I mean, wouldn't it have been wonderful? So many things could have been avoided. Of course, when I was six, my parents used to read A.A. Milne poems to me because I have a thing called dyslexia, word blindness. I had it then and I still have it now. So reading, of course, is difficult for me. But having heard all those poems and had them read to me, I rather fancied myself as a poet. And produced the following immortal lines. A seagull lives on a ledge of rock, and its eggs are not so round, or else the babies would never come out, because the eggs would fall on the ground. Now, that's not actually romantic, but it is logical. And you see, although I suffered from practically everything else, I was a very logical child. And that is perhaps why I like the next A. Milne poem, which is called The Friend. There are lots and lots of people who are always asking things, like dates and pounds and ounces and the name of funny kings. And the answer's either sixpence or 100 inches long. And I know they'll think I'm silly if I get the answer wrong. So Pooh and me go whispering. And Pooh looks very bright and says, well, I say sixpence, but I don't suppose I'm right. And then it doesn't matter what the answer ought to be, because if he's right, I'm right. And if he's wrong, it isn't me. Of course, Christmas is a magical time for children, and one of the books that was read to me at Christmas was The Tailor of Gloucester by Beatrix Potter. And as I've got five cats of my own, are you sitting comfortably, cats? Thank you, then I'll begin. I felt very sorry for Simpkin, the tailor's cat, after he'd been so wicked and hidden the cherry-coloured twist in the teapot. And then, stricken with remorse, wandered out on Christmas Eve all on his own. It is in the old story that all the beasts can talk in the night between Christmas Eve and Christmas Day in the morning. When the cathedral clock struck 12, there was an answer like an echo of chimes, and Simpkin heard it and came out of the tailor's shop door and wandered about in the snow. From the roofs and gables and old wooden houses in Gloucester came 1,000 merry voices singing the old rhymes. First, the loudest, the cocks cried out, Dame, get up and bake your pies. Oh, tiddy, 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 meow, sighed Simpkin. And now in the garret, there were lights and sounds of dancing, and cats came from over the way. Hey, diddle, diddle, the cat and the fiddle. All the cats in Gloucester except me, sighed Simpkin. Under the wooden eaves, the starlings and sparrows sang of Christmas pies. The jackdaw woke up in the cathedral tower, and although it was the middle of the night, throstles and robins sang. The air was quite full of twittering tunes. But it was all rather provoking for poor hungry Simpkin. From the tailor's shop in Westgate Street came a glow of light, and when Simpkin crept up to peep in at the window, it was full of candles. And there was the snipping of scissors and the snappeting of threads, and little mouse voices sang loudly and gaily. "Meow, meow," interrupted Simpkin, and he scratched at the door. The little mice only laughed and tried another tune. Three little mice sat down to spin. Pussy came by and she peeped in. "What do you at, you fine little men, making coats for gentlemen? Shall I come in and cut off your thread?" "Oh, no, Miss Pussy, you'll bite off our head." "Meow, meow," cried Simpkin. "Hey, little dinkity," answered the little mice. "Meow, meow," scratch, scratch, scuffled Simpkin on the windowsill, while the little mice inside sprang to their feet and all began to shout at once in little twittering voices, "No more twist, no more twist." And then they barred up the window shutters and shut out Simpkin. "Meow." The sun was shining on the snow when the tailor got up and dressed and came out into the street with Simpkin running before him. "Alack," said the tailor, "this is Christmas Day in the morning. The mayor of Gloucester shall be married by noon, and there is no cherry-coloured waistcoat." He unlocked the door of the little shop in Westgate Street, and Simpkin ran in like a cat who was expecting something. And upon the table, oh, joy, the tailor gave a shout. There we had left the plain silk cuttings. There lay the most beautifulest coat, an embroidered satin waistcoat that was ever worn by a mayor of Gloucester. Everything was finished, except one single cherry-coloured buttonhole. And where the buttonhole was wanting, there was pinned a scrap of paper with these words in little teeny-weeny writing: "No more twist." When I was a child, education was fairly straightforward. My mother would have been horrified, I think, by some of the theories put forward by one of my favourite characters, Mrs. Malaprop, from Sheridan's play, The Rivals. I love her because she always hopes, she's almost sure, that she's perfect. "Observe me, Sir Anthony. I have by no means wish a daughter of mine to be a progeny of learning. I don't think so much learning becomes a young woman. For instance, I would never have her meddle with Greek or Hebrew or algebra or simony or fluxions or paradoxes or other inflammatory branches of learning. Neither would it be necessary for her to handle your mathematical, astronomical, diabolical instruments. But, Sir Anthony, at 9 years old, I would send her to a boarding school, in order that she might learn a little ingenuity and artifice and have a supercilious knowledge in accounts. And as she grew up, I would have her instructed in geometry so that she might have some knowledge of the contagious countries. But above all, Sir Anthony, she must be mistress of orthodoxy, so she might not misspell or mispronounce words so shamefully as girls usually do. And likewise reprehend the true meaning of what she is saying. This, Sir Anthony, is what I would have a woman know. And I don't think you'll find a superstitious article in it." In Alice in Wonderland, the Mock Turtle and the Griffin had some interesting ideas on education. I think I might have enjoyed these, but I'm not so sure about my mother. You see, her main concern for my instruction was, now, Beryl, make sure you've got your hanky. No, you wiping your nose on your sleeve and showing me up. But back to the Mock Turtle, who said,
we had the best of educations. In fact, we went to school every day.
I've been to school every day, too, said Alice. You needn't be so proud as all that.
With extras? Asked the Mock Turtle a little anxiously.
Yes, said Alice. We learned French and music.
And washing?
Said the Mock Turtle. Certainly not, said Alice indignantly.
Ah, then yours wasn't a really good school, said the Mock Turtle, in a tone of great relief. Now, at ours, they had at the end of the bill French, music, washing, extra.
Well, you couldn't have wanted much, said Alice, living at the bottom of the sea.
I couldn't afford to learn it, said the Mock Turtle with a sigh. I only took the regular course.
What was that? Inquired Alice.
Reeling and writhing, of course, to begin with, the Mock Turtle replied, and then different branches of arithmetic, ambition, distraction, uglification, and derision.
I've never heard of uglification, Alice ventured to say. What is it? The Gryphon lifted up both his paws in surprise.
Never heard of uglifying? It exclaimed, you know what to beautify is, I suppose.
Yes, said Alice doubtfully. It means to make anything prettier.
Well, then, the Gryphon went on, if you don't know what to uglify is, you are a simpleton.
Alice did not feel encouraged to ask any more questions about it. And so she turned to the Mock Turtle and said, and what else did you learn?
Well, there was mystery, said the Mock Turtle, counting off the subject on his flappers. Mystery, ancient and modern, and seography, and then there was drawling. The drawling master was an old conger eel. He used to come once a week. He taught us drawling, stretching and fainting in coils.
What was that like? Said Alice.
Well, I can't show it to you myself, the Mock Turtle said. I'm too stiff, and the Gryphon never learnt it.
Hadn't time, said the Gryphon. I went to a classical master, though. He was an old crab, he was.
I never went to him, said the Mock Turtle with a sigh. He taught laughing and grief, they used to say.
So he did, said the Gryphon, sighing in his turn,
and both creatures hid their faces in their paws. How many hours a day did you do lessons, said Alice, in a hurry to change the subject.
10 hours the first day, said the Mock Turtle, 9 the next, and so on.
What a curious plan, exclaimed Alice.
That's the reason they're called lessons, the Gryphon remarked, because they lessen every day.
This was quite a new idea for Alice. And she thought it over a little before she made her next remark. Then the 11th day must have been a holiday.
Of course it was, said the Mock Turtle.
And how did you manage on the 12th, Alice went on eagerly.
That's enough of lessons, the Gryphon interrupted in a very decisive tone. Tell us something about games now.
And now, here is my favourite Christmas poem. Every little girl would like to be the fairy on the Christmas tree, but how would you like a smile on your face and a tree in a most embarrassing place? And now a story by Spike Milligan about a very mysterious thing that happened to his uncle on Christmas Eve. I have an uncle. His name is Herbert Jam. He was 52 and he worked in a laundry. One Christmas Eve he was homeward bound on a crowded bus when he heard what he thought was the sound of music coming from inside his boot. Indeed, what was to make him famous had happened. His right foot had commenced to sing. Poor Mr. Jam tried to control the volume by tightening his bootlace. It only succeeded in making his voice go from a deep baritone into a strangled tenor. At the next stop, Mr. Jam had to get off. He walked home to the sound of his right foot singing, "God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen." Fortunately, Mr. Jam knew the words of this, so he could mime it when anybody passed by. It was all very, very embarrassing. For 3 days he stayed off work. His favourite TV programmes were ruined by unexpected bursts of song from the foot. He did manage to deaden it by watching with his foot in a bucket of sand. But alas, from this practice, he contracted a rare foot rot normally caught by Arabs and camels. Worse was to come. The foot started singing at night. At 3 a.m, he was awakened by selections from the Gondoliers, "Drake Is Going West," and "A Whiter Shade of Pale." He tried Mrs. Helen Ferg, a lady who was known to have exorcised poltergeists and evil spirits. She tied a sprig of witch hazel to his ankle and burnt all his socks in the bath. But it wasn't long before the strains of the desert song came lilting up his trouser leg again. On the recommendation of his doctor, he visited a great Harley Street right foot specialist, Sir Ralph Fees.
Come in," said the great man. "And what appears to be our trouble, eh?
It's my right foot."
"Of course it is," said the cheery Sir Ralph. "And," he went on, "what appears to be the trouble with our right foot, eh? Eh?"
"It sings." Sir Ralph paused, but still went on charging. "You say your right foot sings. Yes, it's a light baritone," said the wretched Jam. Sir Ralph started to write. "I want you to go and see the psychiatrist," he said, and at which very moment Uncle Herbert's foot burst into song. "Just a minute," said Sir Ralph. "I'll get my hat and come with you." The medical world and Harley Street were baffled. For the time being, he had to make do with a surgical soundproof boot and a pair of wax earplugs. Occasionally, he'd take off his boot and give the lads at the pub a song. But Mr. Jam was far from happy. Then came the beginning of the end. EMI gave him a £500 million contract for his foot to make records. A special group was formed called The Grave. The billing was Mr. Jam, One Foot in the Grave. He was the news sensation of the year. But it became clear that it was his right foot that got the fame, not Mr. Jam. EMI opened a bank account for his right foot, while his poor left foot wore an old boot. His right foot wore expensive purple alligator shoes, purchased at Bond Street, £50 a toe.
At parties, he was ceaselessly taking off his shoe to sign autographs. Mr. Jam was just an embarrassment to his right foot. One night, in a fit of jealousy, Mr. Jam shot his foot through the instep. It never sang again. Mr. Jam returned to the obscurity of the laundry. He was still 52, very happy, but walked with a slight limp. I want to tell you about some friends of mine, ladies to be exact. The first two are sisters, and to play my pretty sister, I'd like to introduce my friend, Miss Yvonne Dalpra.
The two Miss Browns were all that they should be. The two Miss Browns were fairly well born, sweetly at ease whether dining in Mayfair or pouring out tea on a well-kept lawn. H.G. Wells fetched us, Henry James sketched us, and everyone asked us to stay. And nobody realized, year after year, I was haunted by one little phrase I'd half hear. As we strolled in the park, you'd hear people remark, "There's the pretty Miss Brown and the other one." As we drove down Pall Mall, many clubs would say, "Well, there's the pretty Miss Brown
and the other one."
The pretty Miss Brown was delightful and gay, so carefree, so witty, so fair. Her face was a vision, her figure a dream.
The other Miss Brown had nice hair.
And the races men vied just to sit by the side of the pretty Miss Brown.
Not the other one.
Life was just like a dream.
A dream where you'd scream for the pretty Miss Brown, not the other one.
All the peers in the guards, pretty dears would leave cards for the pretty Miss Brown
and the other one.
They said bonbons galore, they said showers of flowers, till you really would think they would smother one. We dined and we wined with the gayest gay set. They asked us again and again. Dear Oscar and Rosie, we constantly met. They called us the Pearl
and the Plague.
At each party and rout, cards would always go out to the pretty Miss Brown
and the other one.
I revolved.
I just sat there and cursed the pretty Miss Brown and the other one.
As we traveled through France, we'd attract every glance of each poet and prince and philanderer. As we sailed down the Rhine, gay hussars would cry, "Hein!
There's the Schönfräulein Brown
and yonder eye."
My life was ecstatic, my brain in a trunk.
Mine suddenly worked out a scheme. I stayed at home quietly, read novels from France, and learned how to cook like a dream.
Men began to say, "Well, she's a good sort, that gal."
Who? The pretty Miss Brown?
No, the other one. Ere the season was out, you would see us about.
The pretty Miss Brown.
The witchy Miss Brown.
The pretty Miss Brown.
And the married one. Lady you can find in almost any locality. She's an ordinary, pleasant-looking, early middle-aged person, and she's desperately lonely. My usual Jim. Do you know this pub on the corner with the awning and potted palms? It's my favourite Chelsea local. I call it the Open Arms. They regard me here as a fixture in the corner with my gin, and I push the boat out gladly as the regulars come in. Just a middle-aged, middle-class barfly, a type that's increased since the war, mixing with people I know very well I'd never have mixed with before. Just a known better days sort of barfly, with a flat at the back of Sloane Square, and if night after night I go to bed tight, there's nobody left to care. I get up in the morning feeling pretty well done in. I have 3 cups of coffee and at least 4 vegin in. I bath and get up slowly, tidy up my small abode. Then round about 11, I go out down the King's Road. I do my shopping, mostly egg and bacon, tea and cheese, and sometimes perhaps a chop or two and frozen beans and peas. Then bang on 11:30, it's the Open Arms for me. And Jim, the barman, greets me with, "Your usual, Mrs. B." Then Nora comes, and Tom and Joe and Bill and Gwendolyn, and I always call out to them, "Hello, you lot, what you drinking, Jim?" I buy them 2 or 3 or 4, and though they think that I'm a bore, they drink their drinks and go their ways, and leave me in a smoky haze, drinking through my nights and days. Just a middle-aged, middle-class barfly. Most locals have got one like me. Divorcees or widows with time on their hands. And as lonely can be. Just a Chelsea public house barfly. I buy all my company there. I get pretty tight. But if I die tonight, there's nobody left to care. Same again, Jim. The next two ladies are not sisters, just good neighbours.
Ivy.
Hello, Frieda.
Come in. Sit down, have a cup of tea.
No, thanks, Frieda. I'm not stopping. I'm on the cad, really. You wouldn't have such a thing as a flute, would you? We've just had a flautist call.
A flute? Oh, goodness.
I mean, no warning, nothing.
I'm just trying to think, Ivy. I know we did have one.
We haven't got a thing in the house except percussion.
I suppose a bassoon wouldn't do if I can find one.
Oh, anything at all, Frieda.
I'll see what there is in the cupboard.
It's as long as it's something he can blow down.
Well, he wants to be able to blow across it, really, if he's a flautist. Mm. No, there's only this.
What?
Well, would that do, do you think? It's one of Mum's old bassoons. She never uses it.
Oh, that would do lovely, Frieda.
I think it works all right, as long as he doesn't mind a bit of coal dust in it.
Well, is he sure you can spare it, then?
Oh, let me put a duster over it for you, get some of the work.
Don't bother, Frieda.
It won't take a minute.
He could have made do with it as it was all right.
I wish I knew where to put my hands on a flute for you.
Oh, no.
There's one somewhere, I'm almost certain. We had an old harmonium with a flute in it at one time. But I don't know till Tom gets in what he's done with it.
But it doesn't matter, Frieda. I mean, this is fine.
Well, tell him to mind the coal dust inside when he starts to blow.
Guess him do everything, doesn't it?
We had coal once.
No.
We did. In the American organ.
Get off.
Great lumps the size of cricket balls.
How on earth did that happen?
We made the mistake of lending it to some people we knew down the road, and that's how it came back.
Oh, with coal in it?
And all stuck in any old owl, of course, at the back and underneath.
No, it's not no right.
No attempt for putting all the big lumps together or separating out the slack or anything like that.
It's not the place.
Well, nearly 100 weeks of it all together. There must have been when we cleared it out.
Fancy.
What's that noise?
I didn't hear anything.
I thought I heard knocking.
Yeah, you're right. He's getting impatient for his flute.
Who is it, if it's not a rude question?
I've never set eyes on him in my life. He just come in out of the blue about half an hour ago.
You haven't left him in there by himself.
Yes, I'd better be getting Matt before he gets up to something. This is the second one we've had this week, you know.
Go on.
We had one on Monday. They seem to be making a beeline for us for some reason.
And what? What did he want?
Could he come in and beat hell out of our timpani, if you please?
No.
I mean, no credentials, no nothing.
Oh, isn't it the limit?
I tried to tell me he was over here on a day trip from Vladivostok.
That speaks volumes.
Looking for his brother.
Just as well it was a Monday.
In any case, I mean, even if he was genuine, you don't want complete strangers coming in just whenever they feel like it and going for all the worth at your timpani.
Well, of course you don't. There he is again.
I'm just impatient. If it had been anything but the timpani, I might have fallen for it, but it so happened I was saving the timpani for Fred and Doris. So as they could have a bit of percussion before they went to bed. Otherwise, I might have let him in.
Yeah, you'll have him singing in there, Ivy, all over the furniture.
Oh, don't say that, Frieda, please. I've had enough singing to last me a little while. I didn't tell you about Wednesday, did I?
Not Mrs. Bargold.
You know what a nice afternoon it was Wednesday. I mean, after it had brightened up, so I thought I'll just have half an hour with my book in the garden while I can.
And Mrs. Bargold started
up. Started up? You've never heard nothing like it. I mean, right through the trellis work.
It isn't as if she's exactly a peach melba either.
Well, I stuck it for as long as I could.
She must have a sixth sense.
Every time I sit out there, in the end I called over to her. I couldn't stand it any longer. I said, I do mind you singing, Mrs. Bargold. But not through my trellis work, if you don't mind.
Well, it's not as if it's just once or twice, is it?
Rock of Ages, full blast at the top of a voice.
Oh, Rock of Ages, well, that's a change, isn't it?
Right through the trellis work, I couldn't read nor nothing.
I don't think I've heard Mrs. Bargold sing Rock of Ages since Mr. Stepupper called her in to sing down the overflow pipe while the stockcock was being seen to.
I told her I didn't have my trellis work put up for her to sing Rock of Ages through whenever it happened to suit her convenience.
Well, of course not.
And it's not cheap either. £2.50 a yard to put up all told with the labour.
I can imagine.
And I've complained about the nails too. Thick green mould. All over them where she's been corroding them month in, month out.
It's no joke getting it off either, especially on her side.
Well, I have to stand on a step like, oh, bit back, it go, and have to lean right over, you see. I wouldn't mind so much if it was ordinary rust. I mean, you'd get that with anything. You'd get that with a national anthem. But this is, it's not ordinary rust, it's thick green mould. She must be able to see it forming in front of her very eyes, and she makes no attempt to stop it.
Same as what Mrs. Bates had, I expect, on her front door.
What?
It took her nearly a week to get it off. Somebody singing Shenandoah through a letterbox when she was out.
And you know what she had the cheek to say to me? She said I was the first one who'd complained. Nobody's ever complained before, she said.
Oh, only because they knew it wouldn't make any difference.
I told her I wouldn't have minded if they'd been stainless steel.
Plastic.
Nobody's ever complained before, she said. I said, no, nobody's ever had Rock of Ages sung through the trellis work week in, week out for months on end. Hey, what was that?
It sounded like a trombone, Ivy. Couldn't wait, I expect. He's blown down the nearest thing.
I'd better just be getting back to see what he's getting up to.
She'll be asking to borrow me granddad's bagpipes tomorrow. Nothing in the house except percussion.
In A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens gives us a wonderful feeling of lush plenty in his descriptions of the Christmas shops. The poulterers' shops were still half open, and the fruiterers were radiant in their glory. There were great round pot-bellied baskets of chestnuts, shaped like the waistcoats of jolly old gentlemen, lolling at the doors and tumbling out into the streets in their apoplectic opulence. There were ruddy, brown-faced, broad-girthed Spanish onions shining in the fatness of their growth like Spanish friars, and winking from their shelves in wanton slyness at the girls as they went by and glanced demurely at the hung-up mistletoe. There were pears and apples clustered high as blooming pyramids. There were bunches of grapes made in the shopkeeper's benevolence to dangle from conspicuous hooks that people's mouths might water gratis as they passed. There were piles of filberts, mossy and brown, recalling in their fragrance ancient walks amongst the woods and pleasant shuffling ankle-deep through withered leaves. There were Norfolk biffins, squab and swarthy, setting off the yellow of the oranges and lemons, and in the great compactness of their juicy persons, urgently entreating, beseeching, to be carried home in paper bags and eaten after dinner. Milligan's idea of Christmas was rather different. A little girl called Emily Jott said, "What a lot of presents I've got." A little girl in Biafra said, "Oh, what a beautiful slice of bread." Christmas in the theatre produces a very mixed bag of entertainment, but I doubt if I could find anything quite so comprehensive as the programme offered to the public in Kilkenny, Ireland, in 1793. Let me read you the bill that was passed on to me by my lovely friend, John Lemessurier. Kilkenny Theatre Royal of His Majesty's Company of Comedians, on Saturday, May the 14th, 1793, will be performed by command of several respectable people in this learned metropolis for the benefit of Mr. Kearns. The tragedy of Hamlet, originally written and composed by the celebrated Don Hayes of Limerick, and inserted into Shakespeare's work. Hamlet to be played by Mr. Kearns, being his first appearance in this character, who, between the acts, will perform several solos on the patent bagpipe, which play two tunes at the same time. Ophelia by Mrs. Pryor, who will introduce several favourite airs in character, particularly The Lass of Richmond Hill, and We Will All Be Unhappy Together. The parts of the King and Queen, by direction of Father O'Callaghan, will be omitted as too immoral for any stage. Polonius, the comical politician, to be played by Mr. Moody, being his first appearance in public. The Ghost, the Gravedigger and Laertes, by Mr. Sampson, the great London comedian. Characters to be dressed in Roman shapes, to which will be added our interlude, in which several sleight-of-hand tricks will be introduced by the surveyor Hunt. The whole to conclude with a farce of Mahomet the Impostor, Mahomet to be played by Mr. Kearns. Tickets to be had of Mr. Kearns at the sign of the Goat's Beard in Castle Street. The value of the tickets, as usual, will be taken, if required, in candles, bacon, butter, cheese, soup, etc., as Mr. Kearns wishes in every particular to accommodate the public. No persons whatsoever will be admitted to the boxes without shoes or stockings. Goodbye, everybody,
and a very happy Christmas.
With Great Pleasure was presented by Beryl Reed, in company with Yvonne Dalpra, and at the piano, Geoffrey Head, before an invited audience at the theatre club, the Redgrave Theatre, Farnham. The producer from Bristol was Brian Patton.